the sea. A stone is not a mountain, but a river runs through me.
WMNF Tampa. This is the Ultrasound Show, and my name is E-Love. Gonna play some tracks for you today, get you into a beautiful, positive mood. And we have Dr. Ray Pete coming up in a little while with an interview. Keep it locked, it's live.
I saw a halo. My reach, elusive.
bit of David Newman with a track called Halo from his new album, Travel Well. Gonna play a little bit of Lamb from their album Fear of Fours, Soft Mistake.
Thank you.
listening to WMNF 88.5 on your dial, WMNF Tampa. And this is the Ultrasound Show on every Thursday night from 11 till 1. My name is E-Love. And tonight we have special guest. We're going to be speaking with Dr. Ray Peet, who has a PhD in biology from the University of Oregon with specialization in physiology. He's taught at several universities, including the Uni of Oregon and Montana State University, and also the National College of Naturopathic Medicine and Blake College. He also conducts private nutritional counseling. And today we're speaking with him about the effects of stress and trauma on the body. Greetings and welcome to the Ultrasound Show.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, so let's dive in. Tonight's theme is really about how the body reacts to stress and trauma. So let's first talk about day-to-day stress and what happens to the body and the brain physiologically.
The first thing is that if you're really healthy, you can meet challenges without experiencing something that Hans Selye would have called stress. For example, if you are not very healthy, just skipping a meal can put you in really serious stress. But a healthy person stores something like 7 or 8 ounces of glucose in the form of glycogen in the liver and muscles and brain. And since at rest, the muscles can burn primarily fatty acids, your brain is the main thing that consumes glucose. So if you're at more or less inactive and relaxed, you can easily go 12 to 15 hours without eating and without having any stress at all. But if you're not able to store that much glycogen, and for example, low thyroid people or people with a history of severe stress aren't able to store very much glycogen. And so when you run out of sugar, whether it's from going all day without eating or because your liver isn't very efficient, then your body tries to increase the available glucose. Normally, just being awake makes enough adrenaline to mobilize as much of the glucose from your stores as you need. But when you run out of that stored sugar, your brain still requires sugar to function properly. And so instead of just increasing the adrenaline more and more, when the adrenaline reaches a certain level and can't get the blood sugar up out of your storage, then you turn on the cortisol. And that's the classic stress that can be harmful, because the cortisol dissolves first tissues like the thymus, which are very fragile. That starts turning to sugar just immediately when you run out of stored glycogen. And when the thymus is gone in just 2 or 3 hours of intense stress, that happens to be one of the reasons they think adults don't have thymus glands, because by the time they're dead and are analyzed, the thymus has been eaten up by stress. So they might have had a perfectly normal thymus until they were sick and dead. But after the thymus is consumed and turned to sugar, then the cortisol starts breaking down your muscles, and then the skin, and the brain, lungs, and heart are spared from stress, partly because they are very saturated in a healthy person with androgens, testosterone and DHEA especially, which block the breakdown function of cortisol. And if your brain, lungs, and heart are short of those protective steroids, then that's where the stress really starts causing severe deadly damage. And the post-traumatic stress disorder is produced when someone has had such terrible stress, such as being tortured or being in terrific catastrophes. They not only deplete their stored glycogen and break down the expendable tissues like thymus and liver, but then the cortisol starts damaging the brain and heart and so on, so they get very severe chronic symptoms. And once the stress is completely resolved, then the brain can massively regenerate itself. For example, they've seen MRIs of girls who had simply been in anorexia for months. Their brain shrinks from the living on the cortisol breaking down their tissues. But once they start eating, then the brain can rebuild itself in just a few weeks.
Now, how often does one have to eat, or is it required or recommended for one to eat in order to not have this stress reaction happen?
Famous Argentine biologist Bernardo Houssay in the 1940s, I think he was the first one to show that if he fed his animals only once a day, they not only tended to get fat on the same amount of calories, but they had a high incidence of diabetes. But if he fed them at least three times a day or more, then they were very resistant to diabetes and were less fattened on a given number of calories. So more or less nibbling all the time is the safest thing. But if you have a really good diet and aren't under emotional pressure, then a person can get along on one or two meals a day.
Now let's talk about a really good diet. What is a really good diet for the optimal health of the body, the brain, the heart, all of the organs? There's a lot of disputes and conversations about optimal diets. Does it differ with different people, or is there an overall optimal and then there's little bits and pieces that different people with different blood types can do?
The blood type has almost no effect, because you can see in even very different species of animal that have very different ways of living, you can see the same processes. So there's a universal animal diet that is optimal, but the proportions vary with the type of activity and your body size and metabolic rate and personal history. Your previous stresses will affect what you need.
So let's talk about someone who perhaps is not that healthy and that does have stress, which is quite common. What would be the recommended diet for them? What's some of the things that they can eat?
One of the reasons that the single meal eaters tend to get fat and diabetic is that it triggers a great surge of insulin, and the insulin then triggers cortisol. And so if you can eat foods that don't trigger insulin, that's the ideal thing. And fruit happens to be the best single type of food for not triggering the stress reaction, because it combines very small amounts of protein with large amounts of sugar and the minerals. Potassium happens to handle sugar in place of insulin, and the fructose component of fruit sugar doesn't require insulin. So eating a lot of fruit, even in one meal a day, produces a much smaller amount of insulin, obesity, and cortisol than eating, for example, just one big meal of meat and potatoes, for example. Meat powerfully stimulates insulin and cortisol, and starches are more stimulating to insulin than sugars.
So it's almost counterintuitive when you're talking about taking in fructose in the form of fruit with people that are insulin sensitive.
Well, for about 100 years, fructose has been recognized as the ideal sugar for diabetics because they can metabolize it without needing insulin. It used to be sold in health food stores all across the country, and you can still find it in most health food stores for diabetics.
Now let's talk about high fructose corn syrup and the difference between fructose from fruit.
The funny thing about that is that if you look at the fructose and glucose content, it seems to be not very different from any old sugar, maybe 45-55% rather than an exact 50-50 balance fructose and glucose. But people actually thought to analyze what is in the stuff other than fructose and glucose, and it turns out that the reason people get fat on soft drinks that contain it is that it contains a huge amount of calories that are neither glucose nor fructose. It's the syrupy component, basically a type of cornstarch or corn syrup, which they don't count it because it isn't fructose or glucose, but it's there as calories.
Now, they're using this in so many different things, from salad dressings to soft drinks.
It was a trick because of the boycott of Cuban sugar starting in the 60s. the price of sugar went up because they wouldn't buy it from where it was cheap. So the corn starch producers learned how to produce something resembling sugar, and it's really like the old Karo syrup, which was not a very appetizing way to sweeten things, but during the Second World War, I think the Germans pioneered it, but in the United States, sugar was scarce, and corn syrup started being used in canned things and even in homes as a substitute for sugar. But the sweeter form, more palatable form, that they call high fructose corn syrup was developed in the 60s in response to the increased price of sugar.
It's amazing. They've done similar things with oils, too. In using oils that are quite toxic in our foods.
Cottonseed industry was a major power behind that. Way back in the end of the 1800s, the gin of to make cotton textiles more economical, they had machines to get the seeds out of the cotton. And in proportion to the production of cotton, they were accumulating seeds that were too toxic to feed to animals. And they found that they could squeeze oil out of the cotton seed. And by chemically hardening it, they could sell it as artificial butter. And the butter industry finally, they were, for I guess about 20 years, required to sell it in colorless state, and the person had to add color so that it wouldn't ruin the butter industry. But the seed industry, seed oil industry, gradually got powerful enough that they could convince people that it's better than butter. But in fact, it has many toxic effects that butter doesn't have.
Is this the same as rapeseed oil?
The first rapeseed oil happened to cause severe heart disease, and the industry wanted to sell it for margarine and cooking oil and so on. And there was a particular oil in that plant that they decided to blame the heart injury on. But Hans Selye did experiments studying the type of lesion in the heart produced by rapeseed oil, and he found that it was the linoleic acid in it, which is still in it. They took out the peculiar, unusual fatty acid, but the essential fatty acid, linoleic acid, is heart toxic. And Hans Selye showed that if you added cocoa butter, a highly saturated stearic acid, to the rapeseed oil, it no longer caused death of the heart cells. So it's just the excess of polyunsaturated fat that made the rapeseed oil or canola or cottonseed oil, all of those are actually toxic if you eat very much of it.
What about soybean oil? Because they're all GMO now.
It's still the polyunsaturated component, which is, it turns into prostaglandins, which promote all kinds of inflammation and degenerative diseases. As early as 1964, I think it was a Dutch researcher named Betcher, sliced open the lesions in atherosclerotic arteries at all different stages of development and analyzed the fats in them. And he saw that he called it a primitive idea that cholesterol got diffused out of the blood into the artery and damaged it. He said that the situation is very different from that, and many fats change at the beginning before the change happens in the cholesterol. And in the most advanced lesions, the farthest advanced atherosclerosis, he found that the content of linoleic acid was highest the worse the lesion. And after that, many other people demonstrated that the oxidation products of these unstable, highly unsaturated fats are found increasingly in the atherosclerosis.
It's very interesting to me that things like these different seed oils, canola oil, soybean oil, high fructose corn syrup, butter substitutes, all of these things are being advertised as better for your health. And it's really about the consumers self-educating themselves and looking beyond the advertising.
They have to think of some excuse for claiming that people should buy them because they don't taste good. And so the idea that if they are essential in some sense, then the more you eat, the better they are. But in fact, it's very questionable whether they're essential as a nutrient at all. Animals can live more or less indefinitely. You can grow cells forever in a dish without any of those, which I think that alone proves that they're not essential nutrients. And the more you increase in the diet, there's a direct relationship with the incidence of spontaneous cancer in proportion to the essential fatty acids, so-called. And that was first demonstrated in 1927 and over, but the industry keeps publicizing them as health foods.
Well, that's the way it's been for many, many years, and it'll probably continue. Although, I think people are becoming more aware and being more conscious and really trying to seek out different dietary options. And going back to the roots, there's been a big surge of grass-fed beef, for example.
The beyond fruits in the ideal diet, the ruminants are able to detoxify the polyunsaturated fats in grains or grasses. And it happens to be vitamin E in the grass, which enables them to convert polyunsaturated linoleic acid into the trans fatty acids. And there's one of the components of butter or beef fat that is being sold as a drug or a health food because it counteracts the toxic effects of the polyunsaturated fats. That's called the conjugated linoleic acid. And you get some of that in beef, butter, cheese, and milk. And the high ratio of calcium to phosphate in butter and cheese comes from the fact that green leaves, if the cow is allowed to eat at least some hay and grass, the leaves contain a low amount of phosphate and a high amount of magnesium, calcium, and other safe minerals. Too much phosphate, which you would get on a grain-based and meat-based diet mostly, the phosphate becomes toxic when it isn't balanced by at least as much calcium and other minerals, including magnesium. And so milk and fruit and cheese give you the main nutrients. And then there are just the regionally deficient things such as iodine and selenium that if you eat some kind of seafood, then you're getting the basic things for anti-stress foods.
So for vegetarians, would you say that it's a little more difficult because they're not eating these products?
If you concentrate on well-cooked greens, the protein and mineral balance in cooked green leafy vegetables, those are essentially the same as in milk. It's just less concentrated because of the high cellulose diluting it. But if you can cook away or wash away or skim away the anti-nutrients, for example, too much spinach contains oxalic acid that tends to take the calcium out of your teeth. And some leafy vegetables have chemicals that block your stomach digestive enzymes. But a variety of cooked greens will provide the same type of protein that milk provides, as well as the very favorable balance of magnesium, potassium, and calcium in relation to phosphate.
So aside from the spinach, what other vegetables would be better off cooked as opposed to raw? And do you advocate any raw foods or raw salads in the mix?
The very juicy fruits are best raw, but if they're starchy, like bananas or plantains, they should be cooked by preference, because the starches can enter the bloodstream and trigger allergic reactions, and too much undercooked starch, it's called persorption. The particles enter the bloodstream and can block capillaries and arterioles, causing cells to die until the particle can be broken down, but it can stay in place long enough to kill cells in the heart and brain and lungs. Feeding mice on a very high raw starch diet, biologists in Germany found that they were very prematurely aged because of the death of cells in all of their organs that were blocked by starch grains. So starch, like potatoes, are almost a perfect food if they're very well cooked, because you want to break down the starch, and the non-starch ingredients of a potato have almost a perfect balance of nutrients. B vitamins, the essential amino acids, carbohydrate in the right proportion. And the only things lacking in a pure potato diet would be vitamin A and vitamin B12. Otherwise, they're a very balanced food.
Are you speaking about sweet potatoes or white potatoes?
White potatoes. Some white potatoes, so-called, contain enough carotene that could provide the requirement of vitamin A, but sweet potatoes often contain so much carotene that it interferes with digestion, and too much carotene has anti-hormonal effects. It can slow down your production of thyroid hormones, progesterone, adrenal hormones, and so on, if it accumulates to the point that it's making your palms turn orange.
Which it does with some people who are juicing carrots a lot.
Yeah, I constantly warn people about that. There are good chemicals in the juice, good nutrition, but unless your thyroid is pretty active, it's going to accumulate the carotene, because you convert carotene to vitamin A if you have vitamin B12 in proportion to how active your thyroid hormone is. And if for some reason you're getting more carotene than your vitamin B12 and thyroid can handle, then it turns off the thyroid function. I experienced that myself about 40 years ago, eating so many carrots that I suppressed my thyroid. But if your thyroid is good, then having a whole carrot every day has some very important anti-stress functions. Yesterday I heard from a woman who said that she had started a daily carrot salad and had almost immediate relief from all of her premenstrual and digestive problems. And we've measured the blood hormones in a few people after they started a daily whole carrot. And it's the stimulating effect on the intestine. The fiber in the carrot isn't digestible, and so the excretion of the bile into the liver carries all kinds of detoxified chemicals and hormones that if you have fiber in your intestine, these toxins that the liver has got rid of will be carried out bound to the carrot fiber. But without enough fiber, they can be reabsorbed and recycled, and so your estrogen tends to go up as the fiber in your diet goes down. and that in turn turns off your thyroid and progesterone, so it can cause all the symptoms of estrogen and cortisol excess. And in just 3 or 4 days, we've seen the cortisol and estrogen level in the blood drop as the progesterone comes up just from eating a daily carrot.
It's so interesting how the food that we eat influences everything about our body.
Lots of people, partly because of a bad industrialized diet, I think lots of Americans are now going around in a chronically stressed condition. It's sort of like a learned helplessness or post-traumatic stress syndrome. The diet keeps people in a high cortisol, high estrogen state. And that's something that if you're going to have any stress, you should, well before you have to do any important work, you should make sure that your diet isn't creating the stress day by day. Mm. And, for example, checking your thyroid function just by measuring your temperature and pulse rate when you wake up, and then in the middle of the day, they should rise so that your pulse is maybe 80 per minute at rest, and your temperature should be around 98.6 at rest. In the morning, it's okay for them to be about 10% lower pulse rate and maybe 97.8 degrees or so.
Now, this can also be influencing the fact that men are having hormonal issues as well, correct? In other words, the food that both men and women are eating, men are also having hormonal issues. It's not only women.
When a man is on a very bad diet or is under stress or has an accident, the estrogen level rises sharply. And in old age, with any of the degenerative diseases, men tend to have a sharp increase in estrogen.
So they can avoid this or monitor this by their diet?
And your temperature is the quickest way, because estrogen lowers your temperature. Thyroid and progesterone and DHEA help to maintain a good, steady, high metabolic rate, even at rest.
So when people get cold, when they're sitting there in front of their desk or at home, then that may indicate that the hormones have changed and the thyroid is dropping.
One of the tricks of the body through increasing the adrenaline can compensate for hypothyroidism. And so some people are hyper alert and anxious and have a high heart rate, even though their thyroid is really low, and their temperature can be held up and look normal, except that it's likely to be higher when you first wake up in the morning and then decrease when you eat something.
So it switches.
Because the nighttime is when you aren't eating and your adrenaline and cortisol rise. Those can tear down your tissues at such a rate that they keep your temperature up. Then when you eat something and lower the stress, you see that your metabolism is really not so high. And when the adrenaline is very high, even though your oral temperature might seem normal, your hands and feet will be cold, and maybe the tip of your nose even, because the body is directing the energy so that your brain, lungs, and heart aren't deprived or chilled. But your body can consider your hands and feet somewhat expendable and let them get very cold.
So if we up the stress levels, and we've been speaking mostly about general stress, and someone does have a particular experience, or if they have a surgery, then there's additional chemical changes, or there's more severe chemical changes. Some of the symptoms in post-surgery can include low energy or weight gain or hormonal changes or even depression and sleep disorders.
And even dementia. It's, lately, they've been measuring mental function after major surgery. And for months, even years after major surgery, people's mental function is often slowed down. That's because of the chronic effect of cortisol, which slows nerve conduction. It protects some of your tissues from inflammation, but it progressively damages your immune system and your nervous system.
So what would be the best way for recovery? And what are some of the things that people can do for recovery, specifically, you know, in terms of general diet, specific things, or your advice in general?
The thing about surgery as opposed to a car accident or being tortured or something is that you can prepare for it. And even standard medical sources are now saying that you should check thyroid function before you schedule someone for surgery, because a hypothyroid person doesn't do well in surgery because their cortisol is already high. Before Hans Selye made stress famous, an American surgeon, George Crile in Cleveland, over 100 years ago, was studying shock from surgery and what you had to do to minimize the shock. And shock, as he understood it, came to be part of shock and stress, as Hans Selye interpreted it. And for Selye, an excess of estrogen was enough to create the whole shock syndrome. And George Crile, in the hospital in Cleveland that he worked at, in 1908, the mortality rate from all their surgeries was 4.4%. And after he devised a way to reduce stress, in 5 years of application, it had cut the mortality to 1.8%. And his basic procedure was to convince the brain that nothing had happened. He called it anosia association, meaning getting the brain to not notice the noxious events. And he found that histamine was released by morphine when it was used to control pain, that histamine brought on all of these other stress hormone changes. So he added an antihistamine, an herbal drug called scopolamine, basically an antihistamine, anti-stress preparation to go with the anesthesia. And then he used a local anesthetic to stop. First he would anesthetize the skin. Then as the skin was cut, each layer would get a local anesthetic so that he was not letting the brain receive any of those harmful signals. But careless, quick surgery nowadays often is very rough, and the patient wakes up with changes in the brain from that powerful noxious stimulation of the surgery. And so if you can get the doctor to reduce the trauma of the surgery, that's a very important part of recovering. And like the hypothyroid person doesn't recover very well because their metabolic rate is slow, their temperature is also very low. And since the surgery turning on the stress hormones turns off the thyroid function, temperature tends to drop drastically during and following surgery. And in proportion to how the temperature falls, the person's recovery is impaired. So everything that will keep your temperature up during and after surgery, preparing with at least 2 weeks of adjusting thyroid so that you're not hypothyroid, that makes the recovery a lot faster. A study in Mississippi, I think it was, found that if the intensive care people would check the patient's vitamin D levels as they came in, they found that out of 278 cases, only 3 people had normal vitamin D. Partly that means that deficient people get sick more often, or that sickness lowers your vitamin D, but some of them had as low as 8 or 10 nanograms per milliliter, where it should be 50 or 55. That's the normal range. And the when he got the dietitian to check their vitamin D levels and supplement vitamin D, the length of stay in intensive care was cut in half, survival increased, and the expenses saved the hospital more than half of the expenses just by that one vitamin.
That's amazing. You mentioned a